19th, 1991. This is the fifth lecture of a series delivered by Rabbi Herschel Schechter. The topic tonight will be military duty in the state of Israel. Ladies and gentlemen, it gives me great pleasure to present to you Rabbi Herschel Schechter.
If somebody is a citizen of the United States of America and he's drafted to the army, so the halacha says that he's obligated to serve. If the government laws are fair, if they only draft Jews and they don't draft non-Jews, and they only draft fat people, they only draft tall people or skinny people, whatever, then it's not fair. But if they draft everybody and they have reasonable rules and regulations, so then this is governed by the principle of dina malchus dina. Just like one is obligated, whoever is a citizen of the country is obligated to pay taxes in that country based on the principle of dina malchus. So the same applies with respect to serving the army. This is what the Chasam Sefer writes in his tshuva based on the psukim in Navi. In the book of Shmuel, when the Jewish people requested of Shmuel HaNavi that they wanted to have a king, So Shmuel tried to frighten the people out of that notion, and he said all of the evils that the king can do to the people. He said, you know, draft your children into the army, and he'll make you pay taxes, and he'll do this, and he'll do that. And the people said that nonetheless they're interested in having a king. So he appointed, first he appointed Shaul HaMelech as the king. So the Talmud has a discussion regarding the Parshas HaMelech, the evils of the king, the drasha that Shmuel HaNavi gave to the Jewish people at that time. Should we assume that Kol HaOmer B'Parshas Melech, everything that's mentioned in that parsha in Sefer Shmuel, Melech Mutabo, the king is permitted to do these things? And Shmuel was warning the people of the rights and the privileges that the king rightfully has, that the king has a right to insist on. But should we assume now that Shmuel was warning the people of the evils of the king, that they do things shalekidin, they do things that are improper, that the description of what the king will do is melech asavah, the king, no king is allowed to do that. So the halach is accepted like the opinion of Shmuel. This dispute between Rabbi Shmuel, the din is like Shmuel, that kol ha'omer b'parshas melech, melech mutabo, everything that's mentioned here, the king has a right to insist on. So it's understood that any king in the world, if he has a just, more or less, no one really has a government with no corruption, so if you have a government that's more or less fair, the laws are more or less fair, that one is obligated to pay taxes and one is obligated to serve in the military if called upon. In this sense, if the only obligation to serve in the Israeli army would be based on the principle of Din and Machus Din, then it would only apply to those who live in Eretz Yisrael, those Jews and non-Jews who happen to live in Eretz Yisrael, who are citizens of that country and governed by that government, so they would be obligated to serve in the army. However, the Talmud points out, based on Pesukim and the Chumash, that there are two types of war, and we spoke about this on a previous occasion. There are two types of war, api halacha. There is a Mochemis Mitzvah, and there is a Mochemis HaRishus. A Mochemis Mitzvah means a war which the Jewish people are obligated to fight. A Mochemis HaRishus means an optional war. If the king decides he wants to expand his territory, he feels that the people don't have any money, and if they'll go conquer additional territories, they'll become richer, and so on. So there is such a concept of Mochemis Rishus as opposed to Mochemis Mitzvah. So the halacha states that the government only has the right to draw the people into a Mochemis Rishus, into an optional war, voluntary war, so to speak, with the authorization of the Bezna HaGadol, with an Ovi and the Urim Tumim. You have to have the Sanhedrin, which we don't have today. You have to have a prophet who gives you permission to go to war, and you have to have this prophet has to consult, the Kohen Gadol has to consult the Urim Tumim, that would light up and say whether they should go to war or not. So if you have all of these conditions met, then you can go wage this voluntary war, an optional war. Needless to say, we don't have any Kohen Gadol today, we don't have the Urim Tumim, we don't have any Navi, we don't have a prophet, we don't have any Sanhedrin, we don't have any great Beis Din in Yerushalayim that will give this authorization. So today we cannot discuss the possibility of a Mochemis or a Shus. So the only battles we ever speak of today, the only wars we can possibly speak of, would be Mochemis Mitzvah. Mochemis Mitzvah meaning for the purpose of defending Eretz Yisrael, maintaining in the Jewish hands, so for the purpose of defending and protecting the economy of Eretz Yisrael. Let's say the Arabs are not interested in killing anybody, but they just want to ruin the whole economy of the country. So that's also to protect the economy. There's also Mohammed's mitzvah, or to protect the land of Israel. Let's say they're not interested in killing anybody, Chalila. They would never touch a human soul. But they want to take all the area of Eretz Israel and take it away from the sovereignty of the land of Israel and annex it to Syria, or have it part of Jordan, have it part of Iraq, whatever. Take it away from the government of Eretz Israel. So this also constitutes a Mohammed's mitzvah. Or if the people are attacking, let's say the enemy is attacking the people in Eretz Yisrael, so that's certainly a Mohammed's mitzvah. If you have, let's say, in Crown Heights, non-Jews are attacking Jews and we want to defend ourselves, so that doesn't constitute a Mohammed's mitzvah. The only time you can speak of a Mohammed's mitzvah is if you have a Jewish army. Jewish army means that it's sponsored by a Jewish government. So in Crown Heights, we don't have a Jewish government. And even though the Rabbalchik sitting called the Rebbe, they call him the Nasi, the president, but still, it's still not a Jewish government. A Jewish government means in Eretz Yisrael, if you have a Jewish government in Eretz Yisrael, then you can speak of a Jewish army sponsored by the Jewish government, then you can speak of a Mohammed's mitzvah. So in Crown Heights, there is such a concept. If lives are being attacked, but let's say in anywhere in the world, even in Chutz La'aretz, if Jewish lives are in danger, so then there's a mitzvah to try to save their lives, and you have to try to do whatever is most reasonable to save the maximum of Jewish lives. It's a mitzvah to krof nefesh. That's a different thing. But in Eretz Yisrael, there's a special din on Mohammed's mitzvah. If you have a Jewish government in Eretz Yisrael sponsoring a Jewish army, so then we have a concept of Mohammed's mitzvah. Mohammed's mitzvah is a mitzvah upon every Jew, whether he's a citizen of the state of Israel or not. Strictly speaking, the wars that they fight in Eretz Yisrael are not Mohammed's or Rishus. They're not interested in expanding Eretz Yisrael. They're just interested in preserving what they have, maintaining the economy, maintaining peace, and keeping all the people alive and healthy. So when you're fighting a Mohammed's mitzvah, the government doesn't have to draft you into the army based on the authority of Dina Machus Adina, based on the Parshas Melech, that Kol HaOmer Parshas Melech Ma'at Mutabo. This is a mitzvah like we discussed. It's not a mitzvah like sitting in Sukkah, it's not a mitzvah like eating matzah, it's a mitzvah like eating marah. It's a miserable mitzvah that people are not too thrilled about fulfilling, going to war, but still. We have mitzvahs that we're not so happy about. So it's a mitzvah that's incumbent upon all the Jewish people. When there is a war, Chalila, in Eretz Yisrael, when there is a war to fight, it's going to be, unfortunately, a Mohammed's mitzvah. And even Jews all over the world who are not citizens of Israel don't have to pay taxes. I don't have to pay taxes in Eretz Yisrael. I'm not a citizen. I pay tax over here. Dinah Machus Adina doesn't. Dinah Machus Adina for me means that the United States laws are binding on me here in America. The Israeli government can't make me pay taxes to Israel because I'm earning money over here. I'm not a subject of that government. But the requirement to go to war, if there is a Mohammed's mitzvah, is a mitzvah. That's not only because of Dinah Machus Adina. Even the Jews who live in America would be obligated to fight. And it's obvious that even, thank you very much, it's obvious that even if there would be a sakana involved in fighting the war, that's the definition of a war. You have to go to war even though you know that you may get killed, even though you know that you will get killed. Sometimes the commander of the troop sends in a battalion, he sends people into a certain area, he knows in advance that they're vadai. The first 25 people are vadai going to get killed. And still, this doesn't constitute an act of murder on his part. This is the way you fight a war. So the people who are fighting in the war, the people are obligated to serve in the army even if they think that they may get killed, even if they know that they're going to get killed. That's not law, that you have to fight. That's the nature of Muhammad, that one is obligated to fight. If a person would not be obligated to serve in the army, he would want to volunteer, that's a different thing. So the law would only allow a person to volunteer to serve in the army if he's pretty secure about the fact that his life is not in danger. But to volunteer, let's say if there would be a Mohammed or a Shus, which we cannot have today because we wouldn't have the authorization of the Bezna and Gadol, we don't have any Sanhedrin, we don't have any Urim V'Tumim, we don't have any Kangadol who's wearing the Urim V'Tumim, we don't have a Navi, so we can't have a Mohammed or a Shus. But let's say the Moshe Mashiach. Moshe Mashiach, we hope there won't be any wars. We assume there won't be any wars. Let's make believe, let's visualize. Mashiach will come, we'll have a Sanhedrin, and they will authorize, for some strange reason, they will authorize the government in Israel to declare a Mohammed or a Shus. And they'll say, we only need so many soldiers. We only need 5,000 soldiers, and they'll draft. They'll say which soldiers they need. And someone will decide he wants to volunteer to serve in the army. No, he wasn't obligated to serve in that war. It's a Mohammed or a Shus. They have enough soldiers, they don't really need him. So the halacha would state in such a situation that since the person wasn't really obligated to serve in this instance in the army, that he wouldn't be permitted to volunteer if he would be putting his life in danger. This is a famous comment that was made by Rav Dovla Soloveitchik, who was known as the Brisker Rav, after his father passed away, after Rav Chaim Soloveitchik passed away. So he took over the Rabbonus in the city of Brisk. He commented on the Haftarah that we read on Parashas B'Shalach. Going back a little bit, before the Haftarah begins, the Haftarah Parashas B'Shalach is Shiraz Dvorah. When there was a war in Eretz Israel between the Jewish soldiers and the enemy, so the prophet is Dvorah, told Barak, who was the Jewish general, that he should gather together an army. She got the Nebuah, she had a prophecy that he should gather together an army from the people from the tribes of Naphtali and Zvulun, from those two tribes, from all of the 12 tribes that lived in Eretz Israel. She got the Nevuah, she heard a prophecy from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, she gathered together, I think, 2,000 soldiers, I'm not sure, it says in the Pasuk how many, from those two tribes of Naphtali and Zvulun. And then the Pasuk continues to say that not only did they succeed in getting soldiers, enough soldiers from those two tribes, people volunteered to the army, they joined the army from other tribes as well. But the Pasuk continues to say, a parak later in the Shiraz Dvora, when she was praising HaKadosh Baruch Hu and they had won the war, so she said, Zvulun am cheref nafshal amus v'naftali am merom yisodah. The soldiers from Shevet Zvulun, the Shevet Naphtali, were meis nefesh, they put their lives in danger in order to fight the war because they were obligated to fight the war. HaKadosh Baruch Hu had told Dvorah b'nevuah that she has to see to it that the people from those two shvatim make up the army. The people from the other shvatim who volunteered did not put their lives in danger because they weren't permitted to. Let's say a person wants to volunteer to eat matzah and thereby put his life in danger. Let's say a person is allergic to grain and he can die. Some people are allergic to wheat and they can die if they eat the matzahs. So a person wants to volunteer to fulfill a mitzvah knowing in advance that he may die. So you're not permitted to. You're not permitted to volunteer to put your life in danger. It's an issa. So the same over here. How can a person volunteer for the army? So if the halacha requires, she got the nevuah that the people from Zvulun have to be drafted into the army. Look, Hotmanish can brayer, they have no choice, they have to go to the army. Or if you have a Mohammed's mitzvah and the government says we need so many soldiers and they're going to take from all over Eretz Israel based on fear, not some, they're going to take only the fat people, only the skinny people, which is utterly ridiculous. They're going to take all the people who are cut out for fighting. And it's a fair draft, so then you have to go to the army, you have to fight, even if you may get killed, even if you will get killed. Allah requires that you have to serve in the army. But if you're not mukhif to serve in the army, you have a mechemes of shoes, the government doesn't really need the whole war. They don't really need you, but you want to volunteer. So then it's only permissible to volunteer if you're not putting your life in danger. Exactly whom does the government draft into the army? So you look in the Chumash and we call some of the information from the Psukim. The Pasuk says that only the men were drafted, the women were never drafted. That's Psukim in the Chumash. Exactly where this is a big fuss in Eretz Yisrael about Gius Nashim, about drafting women into the army. If an enemy wages a war against Eretz Yisrael and they're afraid that they're going to lose the war unless they have every man, woman and child serving in the army, so there's no question about it, you have everybody serving the army. But the government of Eretz Yisrael doesn't need 100% of the population serving in the army. They have less than half of the people in the army. So the question is it proper to draft men and women, or should they see to it that only the men are drafted? So it would appear, Rabbi Soloveitchik pointed out, it would appear from the Chumash that traditionally women were never drafted in any armies, not by the Jews and not by the non-Jews. They never drafted women. The Halacha says that when the Rambam writes this, based on the Sukkim in the Chumash, when the Jewish people wage a war against their enemy, whoever the enemy happens to be, Amalek or whatever, so normally speaking the Torah says that you're only supposed to kill the men of the enemy, you're not supposed to kill the women. And the Rambam writes there are only two exceptions to the rule. When they waged the war against the seven nations in Eretz Yisrael, the Knani, the Chiti, Amori, the Prizi, the Rusi, the Girgashi, those seven nations, and the Torah says, Loi sechaye kol neshama, you're not allowed to let anybody live. So the Pasuk, the Rambam quotes, the Pasuk says explicitly, Loi sechaye kol neshama means men, women, and children, everybody. Normally the Rambam writes, normally you only kill the men, not the women, and you only kill the older men and not the children. On Noshim Bahataf, the Chumash describes, when they waged the war against Minyad, against the Midyanim, so they let the women live. And the top, they also let live. The younger children, who were men, they also let live. But there are two wars, the Rambam writes, where you have to kill men, women, children, everybody. So the one war is the Mohammed Zayin Amamim, when you fight against the seven nations. And the other war is when you fight against Amalek. So the Torah says, Tim Chesech Amalek, you wipe out Amalek totally. So regarding the Zayin Amamim, we understand a little bit why this should be an exception to the rule. Why is the rule, why does the rule say that you only kill the men, you don't kill the women, you don't kill the children? Because it's understood you only kill those who are in combat. You're not supposed to kill a civilian. So only the men are in the army, the women and the children are not serving in the army. So that's why the Torah says you only kill the men, namely those who are in combat. The women means the civilians, or the children are civilians, so you're not supposed to kill them. Why does the Torah make two exceptions to the rule regarding Zion Amamim, the seven nations, and Lochemes Amalek? So the Zion Amamim, when you look in the Rambam, it will become very clear and obvious that basically it's not a mitzvah milchama, it's not a mitzvah to wage war against these seven nations. The Rambam writes like this: if you're walking down the street one fine day in Eretz Yisrael or anywhere, and you bump into a person from the seven nations, the Knani, the Chiti, Amori, the Prizni, and so on, and you have in your power to kill that person, you don't kill him. So the Rambam writes, you have been mevatel a mitzvah. Why have you violated a mitzvah? Let's say a person doesn't put on tefillin one day, so he was mevatel a mitzvah. A person doesn't recite Kiddush on Shabbos, he eats a meal and he doesn't recite Birchas Hamazon, so he's mevatel a mitzvah. A person doesn't say Kriya Shema one day, he's mevatel a mitzvah. Why was he mevatel a mitzvah? He's walking down the streets, peacetime. No one is waging any war. Isn't the mitzvah to wage war against the seven nations when you have a war? But if you're walking down the street and everybody's at peace, we're at peace with all these nations, there happens to be one Kanani walking down the street, so why do I have to kill him? So you see from the Rambam that it's not really a mitzvah to wage war against the Zion Amamim, against these seven nations. The mitzvah is to kill all of them. It's a mitzvah's hariga. Why should that be so is a good question. Maybe HaKadosh Baruch Hu saw that they had terrible midos. For whatever reason, HaKadosh Baruch Hu required of us a mitzvah's hariga. We have to kill these people. How can you kill these people? You're going to come and start shooting them. They're going to fight back. So the Torah says, well, the normal way to do it is to wage a war. But sometimes you can fulfill this mitzvah of killing these people even without waging a war. We're not so thrilled about these mitzvahs. These are not mitzvahs like a happy mitzvah, like shaking a lulav and benching us and sitting in the sukkah. These are difficult mitzvahs, but we have to keep the difficult mitzvahs like we keep the happy mitzvahs as well. Not all the mitzvahs are cheerful, pleasant, and joyful, and a lot of fun. This is not a fun mitzvah, but still, it's a mitzvah's hariga. So the Rambam writes very clearly that the mitzvah to kill, the Zayin Amamim, is a mitzvah to kill. It's not a mitzvah to wage war. Waging war is a method of getting to kill these people. But if you're walking down the street in peacetime and you bump into one of the Knainim, or one of the Prizim, so then you have a mitzvah to kill a person, even not in the format, even not in the context of waging war. So that's why we understand that the mitzvah flies equally to men and to women. You have to kill the civilians also. It's not halacha, we're waging war, so we only kill those who are in combat. We don't kill the civilians. It's not a mitzvah of war, it's a mitzvah to kill. Amalek, however, is a mitzvah to wage war. The Torah says, Mechamel Hashem ba'amalek. We're supposed to kill Amalek in the form of war. And the Rambam does it right with respect to Amalek. If you're walking down the street and you bumped into an Amalek and you had the ability to kill him and you didn't, that you have bin mevatel a mitzvah, that you have ignored a mitzvah. He doesn't write that. It would appear, that's how some commentaries point out explicitly, it would appear that the mitzvah to wipe out Amalek is only in the form of a war. If you have a Jewish king ruling over Eretz Yisrael and he sponsors a Jewish army, so then it's a mitzvah that the Jewish army should wage war against Amalek. But if you don't have a Jewish government in Eretz Yisrael or it's not in the context of a war, then there's no mitzvah to kill any Amaleki whom you happen to come upon. So how come the din requires with respect to Amalek also that you kill the men, the women, and the children? If you're waging a war, doesn't Halacha say you only wage war against those in combat? Only against the men, not against the women, not against the children. So Rav Soloveitchik gave the answer. He said the Chumash itself seems to give the answer. What is the definition of Amalek? So the Rambam writes that the mitzvah to wipe out the seven nations, the Zayin Umah, the Knani, and the Chiti, and the Amori, no longer applies today because we no longer have these people. Kvar Ovad Zichron, the Rambam writes, these people, the seven nations, have ceased to exist. The Talmud tells us that when Sanherib came, he moved all the people from different parts of the world to other parts of the world, and all there's a complete intermingling, and no one maintained their original status. The people in Mitzrayim and the people who live in Egypt are no longer the Mitzrayim. Chassidim are no longer Chassidim, the Misnagim are no longer Misnagim. So that's how the Rambam quotes from the Gemara. When Sancheirev came, a Bilbil is called and Kula, he mixed up the whole world, so there's no more Amori, there's no more Mayavi, there's no more Adami, there's no more Mitzri. All of these nationalities cease to exist. The Rambam writes, we no longer have the ability to, we no longer have the obligation to fulfill that mitzvah of wiping out the Zainuns. When the Rambam, however, writes, the very next halach, it's not 25 pages later, when the Rambam writes the very next line regarding waging war against Amalek, and that's a din of Melchama. So there he doesn't write Farabat Zichum. He doesn't write, we no longer have this mitzvah. In fact, it's very clear from the Talmud that the mitzvah of waging war against Amalek has yet to be fulfilled. We haven't fulfilled it yet. The commentaries on the Gemara point out that this mitzvah will only be fulfilled by Moshe Mashiach. Talmud says that only when Mashiach will come will Amalek be defeated, and at that time, Hashem Echod, Shmei Echod, then we will pronounce the Shem Hashem, Yud Kei Vav Kei. Instead of pronouncing Aleph Dalet Nun Yud, the way we always pronounce Shem Hashem, we will pronounce it Yud Kei Vav Kei, and a lot of things will change in the world. After Amalek will be wiped out. No, we still don't pronounce Shem Hashem, Yud Kei Vav Kei. All these wonderful things that the Gemara promises didn't come true yet. So obviously the commentaries on the Gemara say that this war that we're going to wage against Amalek has yet to come. It's going to be the Moshe Mashiach. It's going to be in the future, it's going to take place. So the question is, why does the Rambam not write with respect to Amalek also Kfar Rovat Zichon, that they have ceased to exist? We ought to assume that there won't be any more. There is no more Amalek, and there won't be any Amalek. We don't know who they are. Amalek was also both Sacheriv and Bilbalus Kolom Kulam. And when Sacheriv came and he moved all the nationalities and he mixed everybody up, so just like the Amonim and the Moabim ceased to exist and the Zainunim ceased to exist, in the Mitzvah and Adam, nobody maintained their status as a member of any given nationality, so why not say that the Amalekim also ceased to exist as a nationality? So Rav Soloveitchik and others quote in the name of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik a famous comment that the nation of Amalek is not necessarily identified biologically. It doesn't depend on who is a Benach, a Benach, a Benach, a Yachsin. His father's 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 father, all the way back, was an original Amaleki from the original Chevra. It doesn't matter, no. When Sacheriv came, he mixed together all the nationalities, and they all ceased to exist, including Amalek. There's no more Amalek, but the din of wiping out Amalek is not necessarily limited to that nation that was named as Amalek in the days of Moshe Rabbeinu. In the days of the Torah, when they were traveling through the Midbar, Amalek means any nation at that time or any time in the future who adopts as its official policy that they want to wipe out the Jewish people. Any nation in the world who adopts as its shita that they want to kill all the Jews. If they have a policy they want to kill all the minorities, that's a different thing. So it's not the miyuchad against the Jewish people. Or if they want to kill all the foreigners and the Jews happen to be foreigners, a different thing. But any nation which adopts as its policy to kill the Jewish people because they're Jewish, sometimes, let's say, Hitler killed many non-Jews as well. He killed Albanians, and he killed the Gypsies, and he killed many, I think probably killed many more non-Jews than he killed Jews. But the reason why he killed all the other minorities was in order to find out for why he was killing the Jews. His main interest was to kill the Jews. If you have a person like Hitler, that's what Rav Soloveitchik said, that in his opinion, the Nazis had the status of Amalek. Even though they were not descendants, biologically descendants from the original nation of Amalek, he said it didn't matter. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik claimed, based on this passage in the Rambam, that he says with respect to the seven nations, with respect to Amalek, he doesn't make that statement. So it would appear that any nation that adopts that policy, that they're out to wipe out the Jewish people, they have the status of Amalek, and they have this special din. What is a special din? Because they wanted to kill us. Not in the form of a war. They wanted to kill all the Jewish people, men, women, and children. That was an unusual thing. All the normal nations of the world only drafted men into their army, and they would only kill men. They wouldn't kill women, they wouldn't kill children. When you wage a war, so you fight against those in combat. You don't kill the women, you don't kill the children. But a nation who adopts as its policy to wipe out the Jewish people, so then we have a mitzvah to wage war against them and to wipe them out totally. That's why the Rambam quotes from the Pesukim in Chumash that Amalek is also an exception to the rule. The Zayinum is that you have to kill the men, the women, and the children. It's not really so much an exception to the rule that you have to kill the women, because it's not really a mitzvah Muhammad, it's a mitzvah Hariga. As the Rambam said, that if a Boli Yodo, if you bumped into one of these people from the Zayin Umays, and you didn't kill him, you're Mavatla mitzvah. But Amalek is really a mitzvah Muhammad. And nonetheless, it's an exception to the rule that you have to kill everybody, even the civilians, because that's the definition of Amalek. Amalek means that nation that set out as its policy to wipe out the Jewish nation, not just to wage war against us. So this seems to be the source in the Chumash, that they never used to draft women to the army, not by the Jewish nations, not by the non-Jewish nations. That means if you can have an army that'll serve the function of protecting the land without drafting women, if you have no choice, you just don't have enough people, you have to draft everybody, or you have to draft 75% of the population, so of course you have to draft the women, finish Kendrair. But in Eretz Yisrael, they have much less than, they have an army with much less than 50%, like the United States. Well, we have, let's assume that half of the nation is men, half of the nation is women.
the United States Army ever had more than 50% of the population? Of course not. What country has more than 50% of the population in the army? You don't need so much into the, unless you have a tiny little nation. But certainly now, Eretz Yisrael doesn't need more than 50% of the population. So that's why it's not proper to draft the women into the army. So the halacha says that women are not supposed to be drafted into the army. The pasuk says in Chumash also that the children are not, taf are not drafted into the army. How old do you have to be obligated to serve in the army? So the pasuk says many times over from the age of 20. The beres mishan mamalakol ha'ivar apkudim. And it says the Feirish, Kol Yotzei Tzov Ovi Yisrael. And Rashi says on Chumash, he quotes from the Sifrei, Kol Yotzei Tzov Malameh, the pasuk teaches you that anyone who is younger than 20 would not be drafted into the army. If a fellow wants to volunteer to the army before the age of 20, so then it depends. If he's volunteering into the army and he puts himself into a Mokum Sakona, then he's not allowed to. If they draft you, then you have to go, if they have a right to draft, then you have to go into the army even though your life may be in danger. That's the halacha, that his ruler in Naftali had to go to the army in the days of Devorah and Sisera and Yoel and that whole story in the Naftar of Bishalach, even though Amcheref Nafshalom, even though they put their lives in danger because they were required to go to the army. But the Misnagim Gaon, those who were volunteering to the army who weren't obligated, you're not permitted to volunteer if you put your life in danger. So one who's not 20 years old is not permitted to volunteer if he's going to put himself in danger. Is there any upper limit? Is there any age after which the government has no right to draft people? It means that they have enough people to go. If they don't have enough, so they draft everybody. Men, children, Rabbanim, Talmid Chacham, everybody. But we're talking if they have enough. So is there any upper limit? So there is a Sifrei commenting on the Pasuk in Chumash, Ish Hayari Veracha Leibov. It says in the Chumash that one who is petrified of war should not be drafted into the army, because he'll ruin the morale of the other soldiers. They'll see that he's trembling and frightened, and all the soldiers will start running away, so it's no good. So what is the mashmas of the pasuk? A person is afraid. So the Sifrei comments on that pasuk that there's an upper age. When a person reaches a certain age, we declare automatically that he's a Yorei Veracha Leibov. What is the age? So the text as we read it in the Sifrei says the age of 40. The age of 40? The age of 40, people are afraid. So the Malbim in his commentary on the Sifrei, as well as the Rashash and his commentary on the Gemara, the end of Masechta Shabbos, they both think that there must be a misprint. And the Sifrei probably has to say the age of 60. People after 60 start to get nervous and petrified about war. People 40 years old, they make very good soldiers. How can you say a person 40 years old is a Yorei Veracha Leibov? The Rambam doesn't quote that din, that a person, Rambam quotes the other din, that you don't draft people before the age of 20, but he doesn't quote the din that one is past the age of 40, nor one is past the age of 60. He doesn't quote that there's any upper limit. So this leads some mafarshim to assume that the Rambam doesn't hold from that din, that there is no upper limit at all. That the Gemara never mentioned this drasha from the Sifrei. In fact, we have other comments in the Gemara. The Gemara says, Hayori Veracha Leiva means a person who is actually petrified when he sees a war. Or the Gemara has other comments on the puzzle. The Gemara never says that it has to do with an upper age limit. If past a certain age, you don't draft the people in the army. So some say that we don't accept that comment from the Sifra.
Just on the subject of volunteering and putting your life in danger as a volunteer, if it would be a milchemes mitzvah, I mean, we're not drafted, we're 18 years old, wouldn't it be perhaps possible to volunteer under the halacha of rodeif?
Rodeif is a din. I am permitted and obligated to do whatever I can to save someone's life, even at the expense of killing and murdering the person who wants to kill him. But that's only if my life is not in danger. Am I permitted to go? Let's say I walk in the street and I see someone is attacking someone else. And I know that if I'll go over and tap the fellow on the shoulder, he may turn around and shoot me. He may stab me to death. So am I permitted? Am I obligated or even permitted to stick my nose in? I know that he may kill me. I'm obligated to call the police. Okay. I can't go wrong if I call the police. But am I permitted to go over and start intervening physically when I know that he may kill me? Probably not. Probably not, unless I know karate wrong. Unless I carry my own gun, my own knife. But if there's a suffix up on it to me, I'm probably not permitted to.
In the meantime, if you see someone drowning and you don't know how to swim, stuff like that, you don't have to put yourself
in the limit. How many things do you have to do something like that? If I see someone drowning, I know how to swim, then I'm obligated absolutely to spend a lot of time, to spend a lot of money, to spend a lot of effort and energy in order to save his life. But if I don't know how to swim, so I may drown myself, so then I'm not obligated. So we have before the age of 20, the Pasuk says that you're not supposed to draft anyone. If they want to volunteer, it's intake, provided they don't put themselves into Sakana. And of course, this before the age of 20 means if you have enough soldiers without them. If you have enough soldiers who can fight without them. Is there an upper limit to that sort of question? The Sifrei, as we have the reading, says after the age of 40, you can't draft anybody to the army. The Malbim and the Rashash say that there must be a misprint, should say after the age of 60. Then there's another pasuk. There's this comment made by the Sifrei on another pasuk in Shoftim. The Sifrei says, based on the pasuk, that you can only draft people into the army who have two arms, two feet, two eyes, and two ears. Rashi sums it up, the kitzur, balimun. You don't draft into the army one who's missing an eyelid, a balimun. Why exactly shouldn't you, why can't you draft one as a balimun? That's it, a movie star, but they're going to show the pictures on television, you want to have that kid, good looking soldiers. So one of the commentaries writes on the Rashi, the Gurari, the Maharal Prague, writes in his, has a running commentary on Rashi Alatera, very fascinating, the Gurari, I think, has a lot of interesting comments there on Kabbalah and Shat and Gemara and Halacha, everything all blended in together. So the Maharal Prague writes in his commentary, Gurari, on that Rashi, that if a person is a balmum, he's missing a limb in an obvious fashion, and people know about it, you see he's missing an eye or something like that, so he may be in a depressed state, and he may not be a good fighter, because to begin with, he's not so keen about his life. Again, this comment that Rashi quotes from the Sifrei, that one who is a balmum cannot be drafted into the army, the Rambam doesn't quote this thing. It's not that it's so explicit in the Chumash that the Rambam doesn't have to quote it. Whatever is explicit in the Chumash, the Rambam doesn't have to quote. The Rambam writes in his introduction to this Sefer, that he wrote this Sefer, the Yad HaZaker, as a supplement to the Tanakh. He says, all you have to do is read the whole Tanakh from the beginning to the end. Read my Sefer, the Yad HaZaker, the Mishnah Torah, and then you know all there is to know about Halacha L'Maaseh. You won't have to use any more words. You won't have to look back in the Gemara, you won't have to study any other commentary. So this is not so explicit in the Tanakh that you don't draft one who is a Balmum. It's a drasha that the Sifrei has based on the passage which the Gemara never quotes this drasha. And if the Rambam leaves it out, so the Minhag Skinach comments, it would appear as if the Rambam doesn't hold to that din.
What is not the case of Chabad, even the Bachut of the Chayim, and then the Bachut of the Chayim, and you have a case where the state requires that you go into serve at age 18?
The United States government. These dinim are only for the Jewish army. These dinim are not necessarily for any other non-Jewish government. Any non-Jewish government can make up laws, whatever is fair. They have the right to make up fair laws. But the Israeli government should really follow these laws. And that's so that you have people who are young, much younger than the age of 20. So that's a question. Because a person who's not yet 20, not only is he not obligated to go to the army, the question is he even permitted to volunteer to go to the army because he may be putting his life in danger. And our officer says that the government only had a right to draft him after the age of 20. That's the problem. I'm not familiar. I'm sure it's not 40.
No, I think it's around 50. You don't have to go anymore.
I got
it. Can you volunteer? They have a system. I think they make you a citizen of Israel quickly and then they draft you.
Sorry?
I think they make you a citizen of Israel and then they draft you.
If you're interested in it, they don't force anybody to become a citizen. But if you want to volunteer to the army, I think they'll make you quickly into a citizen and then they'll draft you. I think so. I'm not sufficiently familiar.
But you're automatically a citizen. Every Jew is automatically a citizen.
Yes, to apply to citizenship. Yes, to apply to citizenship.
The person's a soldier, and he's in the army. If an officer asks for volunteers for a particularly dangerous mission, is he permitted to volunteer today? He's already in the army.
They have to have somebody, so that you can't say that that's prohibited to volunteer. So it's best to take the people who are interested in fighting. They'll fight better than the others who are forced into it. So someone has to volunteer. You can't say that it's prohibited to volunteer because you're putting your life in danger. Someone's going to have to volunteer. We're waging a war that's a Mohammed's mitzvah. Someone has to fight. So it's better to have volunteers than to have people forced into it. So again, let's just run through some of the rules and regulations as to who is drafted. So the women are not supposed to be drafted. Children before the age of 20 are not supposed to be drafted. After the age of 40, or probably after the age of 60, are not supposed to have people drafted into the army. And then there's a question regarding Kohanim and Levim. Can you draft Kohanim and Levim into the army? What's the yichus of Kohanim and Levim? Kohanim, we can understand a little bit, because what is an army for? They don't play games, they don't play pinach on the army, they kill people. They have dead bodies laying around over there. So Kohanim are prohibited to come in contact with dead bodies, whether Jewish or non-Jewish dead bodies. If it's a non-Jewish dead body, so there's room to be a little bit lenient if you're not actually touching the dead body, but it's only an issue of oil. If you're just in the same room, there may be room to be lenient if it's a Jewish dead body.
Jewish soldiers are also going to get killed when you wage war, not only the enemy loses soldiers, the Jewish side also loses soldiers, so if you have Jewish dead bodies, the Kohen has to be careful, doubly careful. Not only is he not permitted to come in contact, physical contact with the body,
to touch the body or to push the body around, move it, he's not even permitted to be in the same mohel with the dead body. So that's why there was an opinion that you're not permitted to draft Kohanim into the army, into any army in the world. This was a big issue. The big issue came up in the British army. When the British government was drafting Jews into the army 70, 80 years ago, I guess. So it must have been the time of the First World War. So a group of Kohanim who didn't want to go to the army said,
it's against the religious principles. You can't draft Kohanim into the army. So at that time it was a big issue, and the Rabbanim wrote the essays about it, the English Rabbanim wrote essays about it, and they all came to the conclusion that they think that all the governments may draft Kohanim into the army. It's interesting, one of the Gedolim who lived in Vilna about 100 years ago when the Vilna Shas was being printed, Rabbi Tzalo Vilna was one of, there were two brothers, there was Rabbi Tzalo Vilna, Rabbi Shlomo Vilna. So Rabbi Shlomo Vilna has a sefer that's called Binyan Shlomo,
where he discusses the following. He makes an assumption. He was a Kohen. He and his brother, Abtzal, were both Kohanim. And he makes an assumption that Kohanim cannot be drafted to the army, any army, because of Tumas Ameis, because they're not permitted to come in contact with dead bodies. In the army, that's all you have all the time, a dead body. Either the enemy or your own dead body, Khalil. And so he works on the assumption Kohanim may not be drafted. And then he works on the assumption that women are exempt from listening to Parsha Zohar. Because it says in the Sefer Achinuch that the mitzvah to read the story the Shabbos before Purim, they have to go to shul, the men have to go to shul to hear Parsha Zohar. That mitzvah only applies to men, not to women, because we don't draft women into the army. We don't even draft women into the army when we're reading Parsha Zohar. We have to wage war against the Amalekim and kill the men, the women, and the children. But still, we don't draft the women into the army, even for that purpose. We only draft men into the army. So the women are exempt from listening to Parsha Zohar, the Sefer Achinuch, because we don't draft women into the army, so they have no business with this mitzvah. So if women are exempt, so Kohanim are also exempt from Parsha Zohar. Because he can't direct the army into the army either. So if the Kohen is exempt from the mitzvah, then if he's a Valkyrie in shul, if the Kohen happens to be the Valkyrie, then he cannot be like the other people in shul, because can a woman be the Valkyrie in shul? No, because the woman is not mechuyev to hear Kiyah Shaker. If she doesn't want to, she doesn't have to. So the Mishnah says in Rosh Hashanah that the Valkyrie has to be a person, a man who is passed by mitzvah and can't be a woman, has to be a person who is obligated in that mitzvah. Whoever is not obligated cannot do the mitzvah to be like the others. Let's say the father's away on a business trip for Shabbos, so you don't have the little boy who's not yet bar mitzvah, so you kiddush. You have the mother who's past bas mitzvah. You have an older daughter. You can't have a child who's not bar mitzvah. He's not mechuyev the daughter. A lot of people make a mistake. They don't realize the father's out of town, so they ask a little boy before bar mitzvah, he should say kiddush and have a daughter. You can't do that. So that Shlomo Levilna had this, had quite an imagination. So he put all of these ideas together. He thought that Kohanim are exempt. You're not permitted to draft Kohanim into the army, just like you can't draft women, and therefore Kohanim are exempt from Parsha Zohar, just like women are exempt from Parsha Zohar. And therefore, if the Balkari English happens to be a Kohen, he can't blame Parsha Zohar. He can blame the rest of the Parshas Hashem. He can't blame that Parshas Zohar to be late to the others, because he's not obligated in that mitzvah. So when he showed his sefer to his brother, his older brother, Rabbi Tzal Zomer, Rabbi Shlomo Levilna was a super genius, and he speaks about his older brother, Rabbi Tzal Zomer, he was the real genius of the family. We don't have too much from Rabbi Tzal. We have a little bit from Rabbi Shlomo Levilna. He thought he was a genius, but he speaks of his brother, Moses. So he says he showed his sefer to the brother before it was printed. His brother told him that part, that essay, is absolutely wrong, and he should delete that essay.
Which he did. He left that out from the sefer, but he left it in the table of contents. He has in a table of contents, he writes essay number, every essay, 1, 2, 3 goes in order, and he has in this essay, he's going to explain why Kohanim can't lay Parsha Zohar, and then he puts in parentheses, but I took it out of the safe because my brother said it was wrong. But you read already just in the table of contents, you read already what his idea was. So in other words, the brother said it's wrong because from the Gemara it would appear that you can draft Kohanim into the army. The Gemara in the first part of the Constitution speaks about Kohanim, we're in the army, how they get into the army, what they volunteer. Which we should have been going to volunteer. A chaplain, yeah. And Mishael Muhammad was a chaplain.
But he had no army, but he had...
Not in combat, yeah. Like chaplains, like chaplain American army. The chaplains of American army are not permitted to pick up a gun, even in self-defense. That's what I was told by a chaplain.
They're civilians. They're non-combatant chaplains.
If a Kohen kills someone, he's not committed to duchen. The Gemara says if a Kohen kills someone, he's not committed to duchen. The question is, what if he killed, let's say he was driving a car and he killed someone by accident, or he talked and murdered someone on purpose or whatever, even if he's chayav b'tshuva. What if he's with the Israeli army and he killed some members of the PLO? He did a mitzvah. So they say also that he's not committed to duchen. So this is a big question. Rabbi Soloveitchik was asked this question 25 years ago, and he said no, that they're not allowed to duchen. Even though they did a mitzvah. Never again. That a Kohen who killed, even though he killed the Macha mitzvah, he did a big mitzvah.
They're not permitted to serve. They're not permitted to duchen, and his proof was from the passage in Novi, where David HaMelech was interested in building the temple, and the prophet told him, no, Dam Rav Shafakta, you killed a lot of people, and if one of the Beis HaMikdash has to be a place of peace, he's going to have a son who will be peaceful, his name will be Shlomo, he'll be an Ishalom, there'll be peace during his lifetime, and he'll build the Beis HaMikdash. And Pinchas also killed a Goy, Pinchas killed Zimri,
he killed
a Jew, he killed Goy, and he did a mitzvah. And the Zohar asked the Kasha, how could he possibly serve later on as a Kohen and bring Karbanos in the Beis HaMikdash if he killed someone? The Zohar is bothered with that Kasha. So that was an exception to the rule. The Zohar says that was really an exception to the rule.
Before he became a Kohen.
That could be the answer. The Zohar doesn't give that answer. That's what Rav Soloveitchik suggests, maybe because he killed before he became a Kohen, so the law didn't apply. But it would appear from the passage in Novi regarding David HaMelech and from the passage in the Zohar regarding Pinchas, that even if a Kohen killed an Israeli army, he killed the enemy, and he did a mitzvah by killing the enemy, still he's not permitted to do it. And the former chief rabbi of Eretz Yisrael, Rabbi Avadi Yosei, published a tshuva about this topic, about also that 25 years ago, where he doesn't agree. He says, no, he did a mitzvah, and he's permitted to do it, and there's nothing wrong. I let me do the passage in the Zohar, which he quotes, so he fudges over it. Somehow he gets around that, but I do a David HaMelech. It doesn't bother me. But he has an essay where he thinks that that it's not correct. That if the Kohen was in the army and he killed the Macha Mitzvah, he killed the enemy, he did the right thing in killing the enemy, that will not prevent him from having the ability to do him later. So this is a question, do you have the right to draft Kohanim or not? So there was a group of Balabatim mainly, Balabatim in England, who didn't want to be drafted, and this was brought up in the 20th century decision. Beginning of the 20th century, they didn't want to go to the army, and to the British army. So they claimed that it's against their religious convictions because they're going to be forced into being the time of the Mason, and most of the Rabbanim at that time
didn't accept that suggestion. Rabbi Soloveitchik said that you can't draft Kohanim.
Rav Shlomo of Vilna, and his brother said it was wrong. Rav Tzal said it was wrong, that you can't drift from. We generally assume that you can't drift from. There is an opinion, though, that you don't drift Levim. Not only Kohanim don't you drift because of the issue of Tumas Mason. The whole Shevet Levi, you have no right to drift. That's what it sounds like when you read the Rambam in the end of Hilchas Shmita
V'Yovel. The last section, the last page in Hilchas Shmita V'Yovel, the Rambam writes about the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu set aside Shevet Levi for special purposes, that they're supposed to be learning Torah, and they're supposed to be teaching Torah, and transmitting the Jewish values from one generation to the next. They should be involved in the Chinuch. So the Rambam sounds like he says that they don't serve in the army. It's a question. It's a question. When it says in the Chumash that Moshe Rabbeinu picked out Elef Lamata, 1,000 people for each one of the tribes to fight the war against Midian, there's a question there what the Sifrei says, whether Shevet, and it says that there were 12,000 people fighting the war. Now there are 12 tribes leaving out Shevet Levi. So if the Chumash says that there were that 12,000 soldiers were chosen, it sounds like 12,000 soldiers from the 12 tribes leaving out Shevet Levi. And others say no, that Menashe and Ephraim didn't count as two tribes over here. The Shevet Levi gave 1,000 and Shevet Yosef gave 1,000. Shevet Yosef meant Menashe and Ephraim together were one Shevet. So there's a question there in the Sifrei, on that pasuk in Parsha, in Chumash Bamidbar, whether you drift soldiers to the army from Shevet Levi now. But even if one should assume that you're not allowed to draft people from Shevet Levi, you can't say that it's prohibited for them to volunteer. If they want to volunteer, it isn't paid, unless they're putting their lives in danger, and that'll be the same as what we discussed before. So these are the people that the halacha says you have no right to draft. Then the Torah has, again, this of course, the Chazon Ish points out, this of course only applies if you don't draft people from Shevet Levi or Kohanim or whatever. This only applies if the government feels that they have enough soldiers without them. If they feel that they need the Levim, also they can't run a war like this. And even if they have enough soldiers, but they have to give the soldiers a break. You can't have the soldiers fighting the war all day and all night. You have to give them a little vacation some of the time. So if they feel, the government feels, that they have to draft the Levim and Kohanim and everything, so then Hafnish can bear, and of course he drift. Then the Chumash has another group of people who are exempt from the army. Very interesting group of people. Mihuish asher eres isha v'lo v'kocha. If a person got married to a woman, he only made erisun and he didn't make nisuin yet. He gave a ring and said, Hariyat Mekudoshesli, and he didn't march under the chuppah yet. He's not living with the girl yet. She's still living in her parents' home. He's still living in his parents' home. So in such a situation, the Torah says that he's potter from the army. And if he married the girl, and if he not only had erisun, he even had nisuin, they did march down to the chuppah, and they're living together, then certainly he's potter. Then the Chumash says that the Shana Rishana for the first year, he's potter from the army. In fact, some of the commentaries on Pirkei Avos point out that the Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos that when a boy reaches the age of 18, then Shmona Esrei Mechuppah, that's the one he's supposed to get married. So if you assume he gets married when he's 18, then Noki Yil Abeis Hashanah Echaz, the first year you can't draft him, and then after a year he's 20 years old. And that's exactly why the Chumash says that you only draft people from the age of 20 and up, because you assume they're going to get married at the age of 18. That's how the Masa Vitri runs. Masa Vitri is one of the Rishonim. It's written by the students of Rashi. The Masa Vitri, written by the Rebbeinu Simcha, claims that that's the pshat in the Mishnah, that it says Ben Shmona Esrei Mechuppah, you have to get married at the age of 18. So we assume everyone's going to get married at the age of 18. Then when he gets married, he's not the Yilabes HaShanach, the first year he can't draft him. And then the next line of the Mishnah is Ben Esrim Lurgos. At the age of 20, he starts chasing. What is he chasing? Chasing the enemy. Because we just drafted him into the army. At the age of 20, he starts chasing the enemy. That's the interpretation of the Master Vitri that appears in the Mishnah, in the regular Mishnah on Pirkei Avos. So the Chumash singles out a few people who cannot be drafted into the army. One is a person who got
married with Erisin without Nisuin, or certainly if he got married with Nisuin, he may not be drafted into the army. Then the Chumash says, Nihu isha shanota kerem v'lo chilolo, if somebody planted a vineyard in Eretz Israel, so the first 3 years, this is a wild din, the first 3 years, whatever grows, maybe that nothing will grow. And even if something does grow, you're not permitted to eat the fruits. This is a law, even a chutz law. This din applies even in America. If you plant a tree, so whatever fruits grow the first 3 years, you're not permitted to eat, that's called orlo. The fruits are asa d'achila, and asa b'ana. You can't even sell it to a guy, you can't even feed it to the dogs, you can't even use it as fertilizer or anything. You have to burn it. It's a mitzvah b'sreifa. The Mishnah says it's a mitzvah to burn it. Mitzvah b'sreifa based on the pasuk in Chumash. And whatever, if anything grows in the fourth year, whatever grows in the fourth year is a special thing. You have to bring those pears to Yerushalayim and eat them b'kedusha v'tahara. That's netter avai. So the Chumash says, Nihu ish hashanot hakerem v'lo chilolo. If the person planted a vineyard, he's exempt from the army. If he get married, he won't exempt from the army until 1 year after the Nisuin. If he plant a vineyard, is that? It's a strange thing. You're part of from going to the army till the fourth year. Then the parents grow in the fourth year, and you're paid in the parents. Hashanot hakerem v'lo chilolo. If you didn't do the chilol means the pidyon netter avai during the fourth year. A very strange din. Then the Torah has another din, Nihu ish hashabon habayis v'lo chanocho. If somebody built a home in Eretz Yisrael, it doesn't apply chutzah. If somebody built a home in Eretz Yisrael, v'lo chanocho, and he didn't have the chinuch chanukas habayis, apparently there's a mitzvah to make a chanukas habayis. So when you move in, you start to use it. That's what the Mefarshim point out. The mitzvah of chanukas habayis is only in Eretz Yisrael, strictly speaking. We have a minig in the chutzlar, someone moves into the apartment,
and they fix it up. So then they invite all the friends, all the relatives on the Shabbos, whatever, they make a kiddush, and they invite everybody over, you throw a party. So they make a Hanukkah Habayis, just like when the Medrash says, just like when the Ribbono Shel Olam created the world. So after he finished the whole creation and after the first 6 days, so he made a party on Shabbos. Shabbos was the party of Hanukkah Habayis, of the building of the world. That's how it says in the opening passage in the Shulchan. So too, whenever a person builds a house, a person moves into an apartment, he should throw a party. But that idea of throwing a party, it says in the Yerushalmi, that's only a mitzvah in Eretz Yisrael. If you build a house, Mishum Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, then it's an Indian, we have a minig like that, but it's not really a din. So the Torah has these three exceptions to the rule.
The Chumash says that the Kohen Mashuach Mechama, the chaplain in the Israeli army, has to be a Kohen, has to recite Psukim from the Chumash, and he has to announce.
He has to give the people a pep talk that they shouldn't be afraid of the enemy,
and they should strengthen themselves, and they shouldn't be worried.
And he has to make these announcements. And whoever built the house, and he didn't make the Hanukkah Habayis yet, whoever planted a vineyard, and he didn't redeem the terrors that grew in the fourth year, whoever married a woman, and he didn't send a year to woman, is exempt from the army.
What do you mean these people are exempt? If they want to go, it is a volunteer. The Pasuk Shat, they should be allowed to. If someone is over the age of 40,
they should be allowed to. So Rashi has a comment on that Pasuk. The Pasuk says, let's go die in the war, it'll be such a tragedy that the wife that he married will be married by someone else. So it's going to be an Amara, she'll marry someone else. So Rashi has a strange comment there. Rashi, there's no source for the Rashi. He doesn't quote it from the Sifrei or from the Gemara or anything. Rashi says, if he doesn't go back home, he deserves to die in the war because he didn't listen to the Kohen. But the Kohen told him it's prohibited to go on the army. Don't come. If you want to go home, go. If you want to go home and spend a year with your wife, and then after the year is up, then you come back to go. If you don't want to go home, so stay in the army. But Rashi says, no, it's forbidden for these people to go into the army. And then Haskina points out, he doesn't know exactly where Rashi got that from. That the fellow will deserve to die if he goes into the army against the instructions of the Kohen. The Talmud points out, the Mishnah points out, that these exemptions, the exemption of the person who is before the age of 20, the one is after the age of 60, or the women, that applies both to Nochemus Mitzvah and to Nochemus Roshus.
But these exemptions of not the Kerem Velo Chilolo, or the man who was Eris Yishuv Velo Lekoche, he got married, and he didn't march down to the Chuppah yet with his wife.
only apply when you have enough people. So the Mishnah says these exemptions only apply if you're speaking of a Mohammed or a Shus. When the government just wants to extend its territory, when they want to take over money, factories from other countries, but if you're speaking of Mohammed Mitzvah like you have today, we don't have any Mohammed or Shus today because we don't have any authorization from the Bezna Gorl, we don't have any Yerushalmi, we don't have any Navi giving any authorization. So all the wars that we have today, unfortunately, all the wars are Mohammed Mitzvah just to defend the people in Eretz Yisrael, to maintain the land, and to maintain the peace, and to maintain the economy. So everything, when you have a Mohammed Mitzvah, then these exemptions don't apply whatsoever. In fact, there's a dispute. Do you appoint a Mashiach Mohammed when you have a Mohammed Mitzvah? The Rambam writes, the way we have the reading, only apply when you have enough people. So the Mishnah says these exemptions only apply if you're speaking of a Mohammed or a Shus. When the government just wants to extend its territory, when they want to take over money, factories from other countries. But if you're speaking of Mohammed Mitzvah like you have today, we don't have any Mohammed or Shus today because we don't have any authorization from the Bezna Gorl, we don't have any Yerutumi, we don't have any Novi giving any authorization. So all the wars that we have today, unfortunately, all the wars are Mohammed Mitzvah just to defend the people in Eretz Yisrael, to maintain the land and to maintain the peace and to maintain the economy. So everything, when you have a Mohammed Mitzvah, then these exemptions don't apply whatsoever. In fact, there's a dispute. Do you appoint a Mashiach Mohammed when you have a Mohammed Mitzvah? The Rambam writes, the way we have the reading in the Rambam, some say that it's in this print, but the way the Rambam reads in our standard editions, it says, both when you're waging a war which is a Mohammed Mitzvah, or when you're waging a war which is a Mohammed Rishus, you have to appoint a Kohen Mashiach Mohammed, a special chaplain who will be a Kohen to speak to the people and to give them this drasha, to give them Musa Shmusa, they shouldn't be afraid. So the Rambam, in his commentary on the side of the Rambam, writes, why do you need a Mashiach Mohammed and a Mohammed Mitzvah? What, he's going to let the people go home? The one who planted a vineyard, or the one who just got married, or the one who just built a home in Eretz Yisrael, they didn't throw the party, they're going to go home. It's not correct. The Mishnah says to that in a Mohammed Mitzvah, you don't have these exemptions. So what's the function of the Mashiach Mohammed? So it's only for the purpose of giving the drasha. That the chaplain should give the Musa Shmuz the pep talk, that you shouldn't be afraid of the enemy, the Mashiach is with us, we don't have to worry, we're going to win the war, and we're fighting our Kiddush Hashem. That's for the pep talk. So the Rabbi holds that doesn't make any sense, because it requires
that the Mashiach Mohammed, this special Kohen, this chaplain, should recite the whole Parsha Kichsova. He can't just say it in his own words. He has to say it as it appears in the Chumash. As it appears means not to say it in other words, and as it appears means to say the whole text from the beginning to the end. So he's going to leave out half of the text. He's going to leave out the exemptions. He won't say a word about the people who got married or the people who planted vineyards. And the Chemes Mitzvah, there is no Ptur. He's just going to say the other half of the Drosha, that we don't have to be afraid because the Ribbono Shel Olam is with us and he's going to help us and we're going to win the war. So that's considered Shalei Kichsova. If you only say three psukim, you leave out the other three psukim, that Shalei Kichsova, you have to say the whole parasha. So that's what the Rabbi holds, that there is no institution of Mashiach Mohammed when you have a Mohammed Mitzvah. It's only by Mohammed Rishus where the Mashiach Mohammed, the special chaplain, the Kohen, will recite the entire parasha. They'll say the Musa Shmuz, the Pep Talk, and they'll also give the exemptions. But Mohammed Mitzvah, there's no exemptions, so he doesn't read the parasha. The Rambam, and the Yadach HaZok, the Rambam in the Seif HaMitzvah says the same as the Rabbi, that there just is no institution of Mashiach Mohammed when you have a Mohammed Mitzvah. But the Rabbi in the Rambam in his Yadach HaZok, in the Mishnah Torah, where he writes the Halachas, writes that as we have the reading in the Rambam, both by Mohammed Mitzvah and by Mohammed Rishus, you have to appoint the special chaplain to speak to the people. Many years ago, Rabbi Leventhal passed away from Philadelphia, I think. The big Tom Chavon, that was Dr. Belkin's father, I think.
Yes.
So when Rabbi Leventhal passed away, they published a volume of a Torah volume in his memory. And they had different rabbis participate. Sometimes, could it be that Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik was still alive? I forgot about it. Anyway, but Rabbi Soloveitchik had an essay about Torah that was published in that volume on this Rambam, to explain what the Rambam means that you appoint a Mashiach Mohammed from a Mohammed Mitzvah if there are no exemptions. So he had a whole explanation. But it's interesting, Rabbi Zevin, Halal HaShalom, has one volume where he writes essays about different Rabbanim, great Talmid HaChamim, the different styles of learning. It's called, the title of the book is Isha Meshikos.
So he writes about Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, and about the Netziv, and about the Cook, and about the Rav HaShover, about different Gedolim, a little bit brief biography. And he writes about the different approach to learning, the different style of learning. He's had one style and a different style. So he writes up about Rav Chaim Soloveitchik's style. And then he writes that Rav Chaim Soloveitchik had a son, Rav Velvel Soloveitchik, who was later known as the Brisker Rav, who died in Yerushalayim 30 years ago. And then he writes that there was a grandson, Rabbi Soloveitchik, who lives in Boston now, who was connected to Yeshiva University for so many years. And the only thing that he had in print from the Rav, from Rabbi Soloveitchik, was this essay on the Mashiach Mohammed, that you appoint a Kohen Mashiach Mohammed chaplain even for Mohammed's Mitzvah. And he praises it, and he writes, look how interesting this Vatera is, the way it's the same style as the grandfather, same style as Rabbi Soloveitchik. It's interesting just historically that essay, that was the only essay that Rabbi Zevin had, that's the one that Rabbi Soloveitchik backed out from. When Rabbi Chaim Heller, when Rabbi Soloveitchik printed the essay, Rabbi Chaim Heller saw it, Rabbi Chaim Heller said to the Rav that he thinks that Rambam is a misprint. And he showed him that Rabbi Chaim Heller printed an edition of the Seif HaMitzvah to Rambam. Rabbi Chaim Heller knew Arabic, so he translated the Seif HaMitzvah. The Seif HaMitzvah was written originally by the Rambam in Arabic. And for many years he used the translation. There was a poor translation into Hebrew, and it's a stilted Hebrew. It's not a smooth Hebrew at all. And every so often it's an incorrect, an imprecise translation. The one who did the translation, Al-Kharizi, Ali ibn Tibin, one of the famous translators, writes in his introduction that he doesn't know Arabic well. Everybody always assumed that it was just out of humility he writes it. No Arabic. So in recent years, it's come
people have come to the realization that he really meant it. He wasn't that illiterate. He didn't read a couple of major errors in translating Arabic. He didn't read it. He didn't know Arabic. He lived in Europe. He didn't live in Arabic Europe. He lived in France. He didn't live in France. How was he expected to know Arabic? Every so often he made some major errors in translating the Pirush HaMishnayos and translating the Sefer HaMitzvot. So that's why Rav Chaim Heller and others since then made the new translations. Rav Chaim Heller's
New edition of the Sefer HaMitzvot. In fact, when he came out with his Sefer HaMitzvot, the Chafetz Chaim was still alive, so the Chafetz Chaim said that from now on you're not allowed to use the standard edition of the Sefer HaMitzvot, because the Gemara says you're not permitted to keep in your home a Torah volume that has errors in it. A Sefer Sheina Muga, a Sefer Torah that has mistakes, a Sefer and Halacha that has mistakes. So he said, when Rav Chaim Heller, that's what they write. When Rav Chaim Heller's edition of the Sefer HaMitzvot came out, the Chafetz Chaim and Gizok, that you're not allowed to keep the old edition, you have to dafke use his because it's much more correct. Rav Chaim Heller in the footnotes in his edition points out that he thinks that that reading that we have in the Rambam is a misprint, that it shouldn't say that you appoint a Mashiach Muhammad. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, Rabbi
Gratzky
indicated that the those of you who are not registered for the whole series, there is an exit fee. Nobody was here for the entrance. So if you could put $5 in the basket, that would be very much appreciated. Yeah.